Hello and welcome to another episode of Engine Nerds, coming to you from Northumbria University in Newcastle. My name's Nick Martin and I'm sat here with Craig Warren and Madeline Comering, and today we're going to discuss some of the most interesting things going on in engineering over the past month or so. In particular, today we're going to be talking about snowboards, Phil Collins and spiders that fly with electricity. Amongst our research article as well, we're going to talk about that to do with renewable energy. Okay, so in this part of the show, we're going to talk about some of our most interesting engineering facts that we found over the past month. And we'll start with Craig, your fact.
Okay, so my fact this week is to do with how Phil Collins accidentally created the sound that defined 1980s music. Should we explain who Phil Collins is? Most people know? I think so, but...
I guess it depends what our target audience is.
Well, if you don't know who Phil Collins is, I would like to know where have you been for the past, well, at least 20 years.
Okay, so I guess most people maybe know Phil Collins just as kind of a solo songwriter and drummer.
Yeah, but he was originally in the band Genesis.
That's right, yeah, he was originally with Genesis.
You mean he didn't just make the songs for the Tarzan movie?
The Tarzan movie?
Is that what he's most popular for?
Well, if you are in your 20s, that's what you will know him for.
Right, okay.
I'm going to have to go and look that up now. That's a fact I did not know.
We more or less know who Phil Collins is. What's the actual story?
Yeah. So apparently what happened was that Phil Collins was in the studio and they were recording a drum part for one of their songs. Often in the studio what you have is, as well as having the drum kit mic'd up so you can record it, you also have a microphone that you can talk into that basically just allows you to communicate with the sound engineer who's in a separate room.
Like a kind of intercom system.
Yeah, basically. So it's not really designed to record anything, it's just really for communication. But what happened in this case was that they had some filters that were on this microphone, I think by complete chance. And they discovered that they'd left the microphone recording whilst he was playing his drum part. And when they listened to it back, they discovered that it had this really cool sounding effect, especially with the snare drum. And they decided to leave it in. And that kind of became the sort of iconic snare drum sound that ended up defining most of the 1980s power ballads, I guess.
So in like some magic post-production world now, I'll edit in some kind of clip of a snare drum with gated reverb on it. And hopefully I won't infringe any copyrights whilst doing that, and yeah, that would give the listeners an idea of what we're actually talking about.
Yeah, once you know what to listen for, you can really hear that sound popping out of all of the kind of defining songs of the era.
Yeah.
I didn't know what this was. That's why, you know, I started looking for clips about it. And the moment you hear it, you can't stop hearing it. Then it's everywhere. And my music taste pretty much got stuck in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, we send all of our facts around before we record the podcast, yes. And I've had Phil Collins in my head now for like the last 24 hours.
I've had Roxette in my head for the last 24 hours, because the moment I heard the gated reverb, I was like, ah, Roxette. Especially the beginning of It Must Have Been Love.
Maybe we should explain what kind of gated reverb is, because I think most people probably know that. Well, reverb, you quite often, you know, if you stand in a big hall and sing or shout, then all of those reflections that are coming back kind of,
yeah, it's the kind of like persistence of sound as it's reflected around, and you can use techniques to kind of amplify that effect as well, which is kind of how, you know, kind of rock electric guitar, that kind of noise is heavy reverb.
And I guess, yeah, a gate basically in sound engineering is just, it just lets through a signal of a certain level, above a certain level the sound passes through, and below it, it doesn't.
And and okay, so you mentioned the word sound, you mentioned sound engineering there.
Mm.
So there is a link to engineering, of course. We're not just talking about 80s music because
we like 80s music. Yeah.
But this is really a good example of engineering being used in practice, because this is nothing other than signal processing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So signal processing, which is something that you'll definitely study at some point if you come into an engineering degree, regardless of whether it's in sound engineering or not. Signal processing is really important for not just recording sound, but recording all kinds of analog signals that you know, basically most experiments that we do and measurements that we take in the world involve some kind of digitization or recording of some analog signal. And so, yeah, there's applications of signal processing, you know, more or less everywhere.
And application of filters is very important, because you want, it's the same, almost the same as what is being done here. Is there certain frequencies that you want to suppress and others that you want to enhance.
Mm.
And especially if you have a signal from, say, a pressure transducer that is very noisy, you want to filter the noise out, and you want to get the actual data out of it.
Hmm.
But in this case, it is more entertaining.
It's a bit more subjective as well in this case. What are the frequencies that you most like to listen to?
Okay, so about frequencies that's not comfortable for the human ear. We are familiar with dog whistles, where only dogs can hear the frequencies, and it's a way of training.
What's that, above 20 kilohertz?
Yeah, yes. About that. Because the human audible range is somewhere from, is it about 40 or, no, less, slightly less than that, 20 hertz or so, yeah, up to about 20 kilohertz. Yeah. Whereas, yeah, dogs can, and that degrades over your life. So there's some nice websites, I'll put a link in the show notes, but you can go on there and they'll play an ever-increasing pitch, and you can, like, test your hearing by seeing how high you can hear.
Well, I'll
this,
definitely
this pitch
lose out on that front, because my ears have been pummeled by drum sounds for years now.
I was going to say, you're probably down at like 12 kilohertz or something.
What I didn't know is these frequencies that children can hear that grown-ups can't.
Oh.
There's a newspaper article that's been circulating for the last 2 weeks of a woman in Britain who has installed a child alarm. And every time her neighbor's children get a bit rowdy, she would let the alarm go off. The children can hear it, but the grown-ups can't. So there's a lot of controversy about that at the moment.
Well, there's quite famously, there was like antisocial behavioral type systems around like shops and things to stop like teenagers loitering on street corners. And they put these high-frequency noises that supposedly only like teenagers could hear.
We did in an ergonomic study where I worked previously, and everyone's hearing was tested. It's so interesting, because the person who did the testing didn't know us at all, but he could tell each of us exactly what we were exposed to throughout our lives. For instance, the one guy did a lot of hunting, and the tester didn't know this, but after the test, they told him, you have been exposed to lots of gunfire.
Right.
And then for me, he said, you have been exposed to lots of machinery sounds, because I can see your hearing is wading in those frequencies.
Yeah, like a notch filter for
on hearing, actually. So one of the reasons that we can hear so well is down to the kind of lobes, in your ear, the kind of ridges and things in your ear, they deflect the sound around your ear in a particular way, effectively creating reverb, which your brain has then learned to interpret, and your brain uses that to help distinguish the directionality of sound. So one way that your brain does this is just because of the fact that you have one ear on the left and one ear on the right, and so if a sound approaches you from the left, you'll hear it more loudly and slightly sooner on that side. So how do you know if a sound is coming from above you or below you? Well, that's down to the lobes. So if the sound's coming from below, then it reflects up and reflects a particular way inside your ears. And if it's coming from above, then it does it in a slightly different way. And that's subtle enough for your brain to be able to pick out. And you can test this if you get like some Play-Doh or something and like kind of cover up the lobes in your ears. So you have kind of like cauliflower ears like you've been playing rugby for 20 years. Then you'll find that you'll lose the directionality up and down, but you'll still be able to hear the directionality left and right. And anyone who's ever owned or played with dogs or knows anything about dogs will know that sometimes dogs tilt their heads, and that's because dogs don't have the same level of ridges, and so they need to tilt their heads in order to get the up and down directionality for to detect where sounds are coming from in the vertical plane.
So be honest now, did you stick a Play-Doh into your ears to taste this?
I might have had a go at trying it, yeah. It genuinely works. It does work.
I think we can do better than that. I think we could laser scan our earlobes and then 3D print a little
like insert. That would be the engineering way, the engineered way to do it.
Yes.
Right, up next we've got Madeline's facts.
So my fact is that the first snowboard was named a snurfer. And why this is an engineering fact is because...
Wait, sorry. It was named what?
A snurfer.
A snurfer?
A snurfer. I will get to how they came across that name in a bit. But it was designed in 1965 by an engineer named Sherman Poppin. Why I chose the snowboard is because if it
Sorry, that's a great name.
Yeah, I know. Why on earth did they change it to snowboard? They should have kept snurfer.
Snurfer. Okay, so why I picked the snowboard is at the moment it's extremely hot in England. I feel like I'm melting. I'm ready for snow, and I've decided if it gets any hotter, I'm moving to Canada. But the snurfer is a... it actually consists of two words, and Sherman's wife named it. It is after the word snow and surfing.
Mm.
So hence it became a snurfer. And he didn't set out to design a snowboard. He was just looking to entertain his kids. So he took two skis, bolted them together, and let his kids play with it in the snow.
And the original, from my understanding about... the history of the snowboard. The original snowboards, like you said, were just two skis bolted together, but they also had like a rope handle to help steer
them. They had a rope handle. There was no place to lock your feet in or anything. It was very basic.
Mm. Sounds dangerous as well.
I was going to say, was he trying to entertain his kids or cause them serious injury? He was like, let's see what happens when we bolt two of their skis together. How didn't they handle that?
See, that's what happens when an engineer gets bored. So we start doing weird things.
Although, interestingly, skiing is significantly more dangerous than snowboarding. It's a common misconception that it's the other way around. You know, snowboarding is like the extreme... sport, and you know that's the one that's going to get you injured more, but actually skiing's much more dangerous than
statistics.
The statistics you know, say suggest that's the case.
But snowboarding was it's a bit of the underdog of the, you know, cold sports or the winter sports.
So yeah, so it's about 30-70 split generally on the slopes.
But it wasn't at first allowed in the ski resorts, because what happened is after the snurfer was invented, it was picked up by the Brunswick Corporation. They licensed the product and they started selling it. And by the end of the 70s, they have sold 1 million roughly units of the snurfer. But it wasn't a major sport. There was a couple of remote until it was picked up in the movies. It was the first time it was in a movie, it was in a James Bond movie.
Ah, yeah, with Roger Moore.
Yes, A View to Kill.
View to a Kill.
That's got to be the cheesiest snowboarding known to man. I can't believe that that made the sport popular.
If anything, it should have discredited this sport.
But it didn't. James Bond, or his stunt double, didn't set out in the movie to do snowboarding. He was skiing. And this one of his skis broke. And he went on, you know, he was being chased by who else? But it's a James Bond movie, the Russians. So he ended up doing snowboarding on his one ski. But the ski resorts wouldn't allow snowboarding at that time. They only started, I think this was 1985, and they still struggled to get ski resorts to allow it because it was not seen as a refined sport. It was the hippies was doing it. And it only became an Olympic sport in 1994.
So there's quite a lot of engineering that goes into designing a snurfer, which is now what I'm going to call snowboards from now on.
It's much more logical.
It is so much more logical.
The construction of a snowboard is what I find interesting because it consists of many layers. So you have, like you said, now you have a base layer at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That is normally a plastic layer and it gets waxed.
Yeah.
So because it needs to be as smooth as possible. Then above that will be a layer of fiberglass to give it stiffness and strength. After that, there will be a core layer, which can be anything from laminate hardwood to Kevlar, my personal favorite. I thought it was very poetic to put Kevlar in a snowboard. Then after the core layer, there's another layer of fiberglass. And above that is the top sheet, which can be plastic, nylon, wood, any kind of composite. And, you know, well, after that, there's you.
So it's a pretty complex sandwich of different materials, and I didn't appreciate quite were so many different layers in a snowboard.
The edges are very important. The edges are very sharp.
Yeah,
and because so that gives you the maneuverability.
And that works by anyone who's seen a snowboard will know that it's kind of fatter at the ends than it is in the middle, and that arc that's produced by the edge, as you kind of tilt the board over onto one side, that edge digs in. And it effectively will turn the board in a circle because of the curviness of the side. And most snowboards, you can change the amount of curviness on the side to kind of get a higher or a smaller turning circle. And most snowboards have a turning circle of between 8 and 10 metres.
I wish I could actually put all of this into practice. my snow sports experience is extremely limited, and I tried snowboarding for the first time in the winter last year, and all of this theory is incredibly hard to actually
yeah. So the thing I like about the snowboard is it's an example of obviously we talked about it being a composite manufacturing or composite structure with lots of different layers of different materials, and that's where computer models and things like finite element analysis come into the design of these things, because the way in which the board bends and behaves, so its stiffness profile.
Yeah, I guess you can kind of, you know, for a simple material, you can predict that and analytically analyze it. But when you have such a kind of composite sandwich, as you say, that's when you need kind of some kind of numerical tool to be able to understand how it behaves.
But nothing can beat destructive testing, because all I want to do is take this and, you know, pull it apart, put some weight on it, see how much you can actually do with it and do it before it breaks.
Okay, so finally we're on to my fact, and my fact for this episode is that spiders fly with electricity. That's my fact.
So spiders flying, just to start with, is not something I think we would...
Yeah, so technically they don't fly with wings. In fact, There's no technically about it. They don't fly with wings. In the same way that there's different kinds of flight that humans partake in, spiders only take part in one kind of flight, and that's balloon. That's what they, what's typically called ballooning, in the kind of what biologists would call ballooning, and they do this to basically get around places, because, you know, spiders are small. It takes them quite a long time to get around anywhere, and if they want to get any real distance, then this is how they do it. And so they kind of basically sit on kind of branches and on kind of tall blades of grass and things like that, and they shoot silk out of their abdomens and up into the air. And for a long time it was thought that it was the wind which used to then kind of pick up the silk and kind of, you know, because they're quite light, you know, that would kind of pull them up and they would fly along on the wind.
Mm.
And whilst there probably is some element of that going on, one of the things that has been proven recently in this particular study that there'll be a link to in the show notes was that actually it's more to do with electricity and the effects of that that are kind of governing spider flight. So basically, the theory is that you've got up in the atmosphere, you've got positively charged air essentially,
yeah,
and then on the ground you've got a negative charge, and this is why you've got kind of thunderstorms and stuff going on. And but yeah, this difference basically means that for every meter you travel up in the air, essentially you got about 100 volts or so worth of kind of potential difference between the ground and the air. And so when a spider releases its silk from its abdomen, that's negatively charged because the spider is negatively charged because it's touching the ground, and that creates this potential difference between the silk and the ground, and that charge is enough to kind of effectively levitate the spider up using
because I guess it's kind of attracted to the positive charge
exactly
in the air above it and repelled by the negative charge that is on the surface below it.
Exactly, so it sets up that kind of potential difference, and that allows a current to flow effectively, which is what's pulling it up.
Yeah,
something that I've found interesting in your article just about the thunderstorms is that on any given day, there's about 40,000 thunderstorms all over Earth.
Yeah, I thought that was remarkable, yeah.
Very interesting. And your spiders have been found. They can travel remarkable distances in this way. They've been found up until 2.5 miles above the Earth and 1,000 miles out at sea.
Yeah,
incredible. In places where they have no business being there, but they just flew there using electrostatic repulsion.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably worth noting, they don't have a huge amount of control over where they're going when they're doing this. They're not, like, thinking, today I'm going to go to space. And that's where they want to go. They're kind of just governed by... there obviously is some element of the wind that's helping them get there as well, but... But so in terms of the actual experiment, so there was a guy called Peter Gorman back in 2013 who kind of suggested that this might be a physical mechanism for how spiders are flying.
And he proved it mathematically.
And yeah, yes, he came up with a mathematical model to show that it could potentially work, and that you could create enough of a potential difference to basically allow a particular weight spider for this to work for. I can't remember what the threshold was actually for the but then this recent study was kind of where some biologists actually kind of tested it for real. And so they took some spiders, put them in a closed box basically, so that there weren't any air drafts or anything going in there, so that the only way that they possibly could float would have been through this mechanism. And then they put a carefully tuned electric field in there, which more or less replicates the electric field that you would see normally when you're outside.
Yeah, similar strength, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Similar strength and direction. And yeah, and the spiders were able to take off. And then as soon as they switched off the electric field, the spiders dropped.
So they
no spiders were harmed in the experiment.
So, we'll cover our research ethics.
So this experiment was done at the University of Bristol. So they took spiders and they put them on a box. Now I have a controversial question. If you put a cat in the box, can you make a cat fly?
Well, is the cat really there in the box? Or is it... I'm assuming that was a joke to do with Schrodinger's cat.
Yes, it was. Nice catch. You first have to figure out if the cat is actually there, you know, because he might or might not there, and he might or might not be flying.
Yeah. I'm trying to work out how I'm going to edit this.
That's why you have the power to edit it out.
I mean, I don't think cats can create silk out of their abdomens.
They have hair.
They do have hair. And hair, actually, going back to the spiders, hair is an important way in which they can detect magnetic fields. So they have these hairs on their feet, which basically respond to magnetic fields, and so they can use those kind of like when if you take a balloon and like rub it on like your jumper or something, and then your hair, you bring it next to your hair and it stands on end. That's a similar kind of mechanism, and in fact, that's exactly the reason. That's exactly what's going on here. That the fact that when you put a balloon next to your hair, the hair moves up. That's exactly the same mechanism that's pulling the spiders up. Only they don't have to use a balloon. Although, interestingly, it's called ballooning, so there we go. We're on to the final part of the show, and here we're going to talk about our monthly research news article. And this month it's an article from Bloomberg, although actually there's been a number of different kind of outlets who have reported on this. And it's about a physicist who's come along. It says in the article title that he's a scuba diving physicist. I'm not sure why that's necessarily relevant. But that he's come up with a new technique for generating renewable energy via wave power. I guess it's quite an interesting idea in the sense that it's a fairly novel technique.
A lot of wave energy converters are designed to operate on the seabed. So they have no kind of, or very minimal visual impact. Whereas this one is a device that is designed to work in the surf and quite close to shore. So it's something that will have a degree, I guess, of visible impact.
Yeah, and the particular, obviously we'll put a link to the article in the show notes, but there's a particular region in mind as well, isn't it? So he's based in the Maldives, which is, I suppose, why he likes scuba diving. And he's looking at solving a particular problem for how they can generate electricity in the Maldives.
So why the Maldives?
Well, for three reasons. The Maldives has a pretty bad deal when it comes to global warming, because if the sea level rises by only a couple of meters, the Maldives will cease to exist. It consists of many different little islands, and that's the second reason why they selected to go to test this in the Maldives, is they have no central power station. Every little island is responsible for making their own power and generating their own power. And the Maldives have a good surf. Obviously, you need a good surf in the shallow regions of the water for this to work. The blades are made of an alloy that mostly consists of aluminium, but it has certain parts of copper, manganese, and magnesium in it.
It's like durable aluminium.
Yes, but if
that's what we should call it.
If you are going to have this type of installation in the sea, preferably you don't want your blades to rust. And because it is exposed to the seawater and to salty air, you need something like aluminum that's going to last much longer.
Yeah, well, aluminium is prone to corrosion with seawater in particular. Well, I mean, most things, the salt kind of aids corrosion in general. So I guess this is the equivalent of something like stainless steel in the sense that it helps resist the salt.
But that's why the copper is in there. Because there's a copper in the material, it will retard that effect.
Okay.
And they are the amount. Okay, how much power can this actually generate? The problems that we have with renewable energy is that you simply cannot get enough power out of it to, for instance, power an entire facility or an entire house. Mm-hmm. So two of these at this stage can power one room. And where they installed this in the Maldives is at a Holiday Inn resort.
Mm.
And the resort is on board with this. And the idea is that they will start testing it and then install more turbines as the time go on. But if you need two turbines per room, you will need a little army of turbines sitting in your surf.
Mm.
Which is good from a renewable point of view, but environmentally, it always has an impact.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth considering that even when you create, say, like a wind turbine or a solar cell or something, quite often you think about the fact that you get this energy for free, but it's not completely for free. There is some, you know, carbon footprint associated with actually generating that, and so you have to make sure that it's efficient enough so that over its lifetime it will, well, hopefully multiple times repay that carbon footprint that you've made up front in order to create the, you know, the wind turbine or the wave generator or whatever.
Well, with wave generators, in terms of environmental impact, the first is the visual impact. Previously, where you had a very natural surf, very natural sea, now you will have a small farm full of little turbines sitting in your surf. Then there is the danger aspect of it. Mm. In some way that you can still get the wave power out, but you're keeping humans out. Then what is the impact on the marine life? But most importantly, a lot of studies are being done at the moment about sediment flow rate of, you know, the seabed, and the effect that wave power has on it.
Although one thing I did read was that these particular turbines had been developed to spin at such a rate that if, like, fish kind of got too close to them, then that it would not harm the fish.
Yes, they have reduced that's quite a interesting point. Is the rotational speed is retarded, so if any sea animal comes close to it, they will be able to swim through
without basically being chopped up. You don't have any, yeah, you don't have sushi arriving on the beach.
I don't know, maybe it's clear to everyone what these things look like, but if it's not, then when I first saw the picture of this, by no means to downplay the engineering that's gone into it, because clearly there's been a lot. For me, it's like a cross between the kind of wind turbines that we see all over the country now, and one of these little handheld fans that you used to get to cool yourself with.
Or even, you know, the little beach. You know, the little kind of like pinwheel things that you get. Yeah.
I looked at it and I thought it looked like a submarine propeller.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's kind of a three-way cross in there, I think.
But there's some interesting engineering about the number of blades and the rotation speed. So when you're designing things like wind turbines or any kind of rotating propellery type thing, either for generating power or for propelling, say, like an aeroplane or something, then you have a really important parameter called the tip speed ratio, and that's the ratio effectively between the tangential speed of the tip of one of your blades, so that's the kind of radius of your blade times by the rotational velocity. And the velocity of kind of the air moving through that, or in the case of an aeroplane, the speed of the aeroplane. And that ratio there's a kind of optimum. So for wind turbines, based on the radius of a general wind turbine and the speed of the air going, you know, just in general, the atmospheric wind speed, that ratio tends to be around about 6.5. And that, it just happens that the optimum number of blades for that particular tip speed ratio is 3 to get the maximum power efficiency. Now for these particular turbines, you've got around about 5 to 8 meters per second of wave speed as the waves kind of hit them, and because of the reduced diameter, that means your tip speed ratio is less, and therefore you tend to need more. So these tend to have about 5, from the looks of it, 4 or 5 blades.
But it's really exciting that someone is, that people are trying new things, that people are trying new ways of generating electricity.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many different ways. I mean, if you just look at wave power in isolation, you've got, there's things called point absorbers. So that's buoys that basically kind of move up and down to create energy. There's surface attenuators, which are things that sit along the surface of the water and then flex, and it's that flexure that creates the energy. You've got oscillating wave surge converters, oscillating water columns. This one's really interesting. So they use the water as a kind of column to basically create compressed air, which then gets fired through a turbine or something.
Wave energy is a good one because it never stops. If you are relying on solar power and the sun doesn't shine, well, you don't make any electricity. The wind doesn't always blow, but there's always a tide. There's always waves. Sometimes it's bigger and smaller, but it's more of a continuous type of mechanism.
Mm. Yeah, well, I suppose it depends where you are on the Earth as well. So, for example, in the Maldives, you might have quite constant wave power, which is what these are exploiting, but there isn't a very large tidal range. Whereas somewhere like the UK, tidal power is arguably much more important. You have like these massive, in some areas of the country, like, you know, 5 or 6 meter tidal ranges. So.
Well, we're not going to use solar power here, are we?
No, but I mean, that's an important point though, in terms of, I mean, this is one of the major issues for renewable energy. You need to have either a clever system of having lots of different types of renewable energy so that, you know, when it's sunny, you can use solar power, but generally when it's sunny, it's not going to be windy. But then maybe when it's not sunny, it's going to be windy. And so then you can use, you know, so you need to kind of have these overlapping sources. And so some kind of like intelligent grid system that can draw upon all of them. But also maybe you just need some kind of way of storing that power. And that's another kind of, you know, interesting thing. How do you store energy when, you know, when you're not...
when there's not demand
for it. When there's not demand for it, yeah.
Because unfortunately we can't kind of coordinate all our renewable energy for that cup of tea at the halftime break in the football, you know.
Exactly, and maybe it's like really windy at 2 a.m. when everyone's asleep, lights are off and no one's using any energy.
In the long term, for me, there's a part of social responsibility that comes in as well. And that is, we need to start optimizing our households. Just, you know, there needs to be a consciousness in the general population that we need to use less resources overall.
Yeah. You know, the biggest thing that you can do to reduce your energy consumption?
What's that?
Yes.
Don't eat meat.
I knew he was going to say that.
Right, that's all we've got time for on this episode of Engineerds. If you want to get in touch with us about any of the things that we've talked about on this episode, you can do so via our Twitter handles. I'm on at @ND_Martin. Craig.
I'm on at Dr. Craig Warren.
Madeline.
I'm at @ML_Gombring.
Or you can email us at engineerds.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter @ engineerdsuk. And you can find all of our previous episodes on our website, engineerds.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.